Let me welcome all of you this evening to our third vocational ministry lecture, a framework lecture series. Just a little bit about this lecture series. This is a lecture series designed then to help us think in terms of a framework for understanding our faith and our work as part of the vocational ministry that was launched a little bit over a year ago. Again, and this is our third lecture. The first two, if you were here for them or have watched them on the website, we had Dr. Bill Edgar from Westminster Seminary, one of my colleagues, and then Dr. Oz Guinness, particularly speaking about a topic that he's addressed over many years, calling. Both of them professional theologians, and I thought tonight especially we would shift gears a little bit and bring someone with a bit broader experience, a theologian in his own right, yes, but also one with experience both in medicine and other areas as well. This evening's lecture is Dr. John Templeton, Jr., President and Chairman of the John Templeton Foundation. Dr. Templeton completed his medical degree at Harvard University, trained in pediatric surgery under one of our elders here, Dr. C. Everett Koop. And in 1995, he retired from his medical practice and began directing all activities of the Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation is a philanthropic foundation with a $2.3 billion endowment. When I looked up on their website, I was amazed by this endowment for this foundation. And then they had on their stat sheet in 2010 that they had given or granted $66 million in grants that year. Dr. Templeton is also the author of two books, Thrift and Generosity, The Joy of Giving, published in 2004, and A Searcher's Life, published in 2008. Now, this evening, he's addressing a very specific topic. If you've seen the title, it's Honesty, Thrift, and Generosity. What is at stake? And particularly as we think about our faith and our work, and of course, from the work side, always generating revenue, and particularly for many of us, this is something we depend upon, but also to think about what we should do with what God has given us in terms of wealth. And I think Dr. Templeton will have some very interesting insights to share with us this evening. There will be a time of Q&A afterwards in which I have an opportunity to ask some questions. And then we'll be having refreshments also in the back, in the reception hall behind here as well. But let me begin this evening with a word of prayer. Will you pray with me? Father, we thank you so much for the blessing of being in Christ, for the fellowship that we share in Christ, and for the opportunity to learn, Father, from your servants. We thank you for this lecture series and how we've been blessed in the past, and we pray for this evening as well, that you would use our speaker tonight to share with us, Father, from his experience and his learning, that we would grow in our faith and understanding, especially in terms of how to be good stewards with the wealth that you give us, Father. So be with us this evening. We thank you again for this opportunity, and we give you all the glory. We pray this in and through Jesus Christ. Amen. Dr. Templeton.
Thank you. Can you see the slide? Okay, good. And that pillar may be in your way, so move if you can't see the screen. So thank you very much. It's a joy to be here. It was a joy over many earlier years when my wife and I were training at the true original Children's Hospital, which was down on Bainbridge. And so if we had, which we didn't have much of a window on a Sunday, we might come down here. And of course, this was Dr. Koop's church. Many of you may have known that. Dr. Koop said many times that Dr. Barnhouse was the one who brought him to Jesus Christ. So that was an extraordinary heritage. So good evening, and it is a joy to be here. In fact, I'm grateful, as I was suggesting, to be here in this church, to address you as a part of the 10th Presbyterian Church. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share three of the virtues listed by my father, Sir John Templeton. These were virtues that he felt were particularly of high importance in the ranking of what he listed as a total of 19 virtues, which we have on our website. That's important to note that he didn't invest, and he considered philanthropy as important a discipline of investing as anything he ever did in the financial world. There was someone who recently wrote a chapter about him and said, John Templeton was a hard guy. He smiled. He was affable, good Tennessee guy. But his standards in philanthropy were just as tough as he tried to pursue when he was trying to benefit shareholders. there won't be too much of that here, but I wanted you to have a context of what the John Templeton Foundation tries to do in regard to looking at grants and things that we fund. So I'd like to start tonight with the ancient honorable concept of honesty. The etymology of the word honesty comes from Old French, namely the still recognized word of honesté. Among a variety of perspectives on the word and the concept of honesty, we have being truthful, integrity, trustworthiness, probity, and that one's word is one's bond, which I will repeat in a different context. Antonyms of honesty include cheating, deceit, fraud, and treachery. And as I was reflecting on the opportunity to share ideas tonight, as a thought experiment, which I think would take time, but one could do it even with the Philadelphia Inquirer, which would now have archives backwards, backwards, backwards. I wonder how far you'd have to go back with the Philadelphia Inquirer daily newspaper, in which for couplets of 2 days in succession of the Philadelphia Inquirer, there is not, by guarantee, articles about cheating, deceit, fraud, or treachery. So at this point, I think with that as something of a reflection, I'd like to share with you something of this scenario, which is my oldest grandson with his father. And he's trying to tell Jack about honesty, and he's talking about honesty, and Jack's sort of struggling with what does that mean. So I'll leave that up for a moment to sort of set this in a scenario that you all helped to write this talk. And I'm so grateful that so many of you submitted your ideas to a scenario which was mommy, daddy, so a very remarkable, always curious 8-year-old, why should I be honest, which is a great deal different than running and say, mommy and daddy, should I be honest, which might deal with some particular, even very narrow, not broad enough, but just should I be honest in this or that situation. You could say to that later question, yes, by all means, be honest. But we live in a culture which I think, for many ways of looking at it, from K to 12, of all the great single word questions like what, when, where, the one that's virtually not allowed in much of education are why questions, which is so fundamental even to those who are either firm in their faith, reevaluating the question of issues that rise up and therefore retesting. You can't really be a vital Christian without always having why questions on the front part of your thinking. So I'm trying to emphasize how important that concept is, and what you all did was then send in your own answers. We asked you not to send us a tome. After all, your 8-year-old child is a perfect Freudian. He doesn't want a tome. If you answer within 2 minutes, he knows that that comes right out of your heart, right out of your mind. So we asked you, if you have time, then just sit and don't take more than 5 minutes and write something not very long. What would you say to your 8-year-old that would make sense? And I think you'll get a feel of what you did so successfully in some of the quotations I'm going to share with you. So when I've asked this question now for some 4 or 5 years, and I actually recommend whatever lecture you're going to do that you might try this out as an experiment. Because I'd done a book years ago called Thrift and Generosity, I used to give, in the typical mode, unidirectional communication. So I talked about contents in the book. And then as I began to think how grievous it was to any society that pretends it wants to be free to see such a collapse of something as fundamental as honesty, I came up with the idea that maybe those who I'm going to speak to would actually tell me what I should put into the content. So I would suggest, as a thought experiment and as a reality, if you're going to be giving a lecture, find some way of surveying the audience, whatever the topic is, and get feedback from them, and let them be able to be telling you as well as telling each other what their perspectives are. So that's a little bit of what we're going to start with. So I have given this talk now on different parts of the country, to Rotary clubs, Christian businessmen's clubs. From the beginning when I asked that, I had no predetermined concept. Quickly I could see, and is true for the answers you sent, it fell into 3 basic categories. The first is the category of practicality, including the issue of avoiding legal and or societal adverse consequences. Second, as we have here, often a very popular one, of responses that involve a number of positive concepts of social, economic, or larger opportunities, and here's certainly not the least, what it would mean from the viewpoint of reputation within a family, within a community, and so on. There is a third category, and you all, of all the people I've talked to, have made this third category this evening trump all of the others, as you'll see by the statistics. That is, those responses which reflect both duty and fidelity to an eternal transcendent authority as a never-ending reason to be honest. Last summer, I was with some people, many of whom were Christians, and I won't go into the details, but I was caught by surprise. Four of the individual answers actually brought up a category which would have been so prominent 50, 80 years ago or more, which was, and as Hal one put forward one of their answers, which was, well, here's your 8-year-old, Daddy, why should be honest? He just wrote down, because I said so. So I thought that was pretty preemptive and kind of sort of like a person who has power, and he's telling you what they were really saying is, that's our family's honor. That when you are of this family, there is nothing that we expect that you do, that you be honest. And the other two honest answers were the negative, which was, don't shame our family and our reputation by being dishonest. People don't talk that way very much today. So anyway, I'm grateful for the diversity of answers that you gave. So to start, I'm grateful to have 39 responses, and there was quite a good spectrum, and it was from, I hope most of you were here, and these 39 responses clearly were assignable to one of the three traditional categories of responses that I had mentioned to you before. So out of your deeply appreciated responses that you returned last week, the lowest and only 3 out of 39 responses, or 7.7%, were those of the practicality aspect of why to be honest, such as avoiding legal hassles or reputational harm. So of these 3 answers, I'm just going to give you 2. One was to the point, because a lie only leads to more lies. Likewise, the other one as a response in this category was, if we do not tell the truth, others will be hurt and sad. That actually triggered in my mind a recollection of some of those who still should be recognized as founding fathers in America, who I sometimes say when they came to Philadelphia in 1787, because yes, they won their independence from Britain, but the whole 13 member states of the Confederation were falling apart. 11 of the 13 states were bankrupt. Maryland and Virginia almost went to war against each other over tariffs. Can you imagine calling themselves the United States and they had tariffs against each other? There were many other dimensions, and I will leave to you, and then you can maybe in the question and answer period tell me your answer. Of all the variety of issues, what do you think these very astute, very learned people were most afraid of when they came to say, we have to reframe the concept of government and what that means for any society to be both responsible and to be free? So you might have some thoughts at the end. What were they most afraid of? You might get a clue, because when I reflected on the word hurt, that's hurt of self or hurt of others, as a result of lying, it brought to mind what Thomas Jefferson said. He who permits himself to tell a lie once finds it much easier to do a second and a third time until at length it becomes habitual. He then tells lies without attending to it, and often truths without the world now believing him. But the most potent part of what he said, the falsehood of the tongue leads to that of the heart, and in time depraves all its good disposition, and parenthetically, I think, depraves the honor, the integrity, or sense of reliability for a person or for a society. So, as we then pursue further, the larger category, which was in most cases usually 50% or more, which was that of positive responses, almost 31% of you answered a variety of positive social or economic or beneficial reputational issues. So 2 of those examples, I start with the 2 below, says being honest shows others that we love them. Another is, because if you want others to be honest with you, you should be honest with them first. Because there were a lot of other things to draw from, I put down another one that I thought was rather multidimensional.
Speaking the truth is important because you want to be trusted by others. Trust is very important. If no one trusts you, then no one will want to relate with you. And then he was remembering he was speaking to an 8-year-old, like play or be your friend. Yet another quote in the same category stated, I would point out how as I as a parent keep my word when I promise to take him to different places to read a story in a play. If I did not keep my word, how would that make you feel, my son? Now the big category, far bigger, is the third category that I've ever had from giving this talk in different locations and different culture groups, is 61.5%, total of 24 responses affirmed a strong sense of duty and fidelity to an eternal, transcendent authority as the central reason for being honest. So I'm just going to share some of the quotes with you. I think what's notable is that they, as a characteristic, are already pointing not at themselves, or in some cases not even on others, but actually centralizing the whole framework for the quotes that you'll see on the need to focus on that faithful, transcendent authority. So we have, God tells us that we are to be honest and not lie. I would specifically refer to the commandment, you shall not bear false witness. A second respondent noted, because God always keeps his word to us, even at great cost to him. Finally, just four others, and I'll pick up one and then go into the next slides. We have a sense of, in the respondents, what I perceived as a kind of an additional astute gratitude in the nature of their responses. First, we need to keep our hearts clean before God. Our parents as children are representative of God's authority. God rules over them. They will be accountable to God for their own deeds, both to themselves and to their children. Next is the concept of imago Deo, places honesty and truthfulness at the heart of integrity and the civil fabric. Third, I think I would answer, one, that God says not to lie, and therefore we obey God to show love, respect, and reverence for God because he loved us first. And then just one other is a quote, which I think has an interesting dichotomy, which is a call to an intrinsic honesty between God and us, and then also to us in turn to honor God. So the quotation is, so God is honest with us about hard and messy things and about big and exciting things. When we are honest, we are being like God, which honors God. That wraps up the quotations. There are many more, but I wanted to highlight what I thought were very good examples. Your very answers gave me even insights and new dimensions, even though I've given this talk in other contexts. So I'm grateful for you all helping to write this lecture. So in regard to the John Templeton Foundation, I mentioned that my father identified some 19 specific virtues. Much of the culture, and even a few of our words, say, well, we fund character development or character education. If you just pay attention to words, you can have good character or bad character. People also say, well, we want to teach and bring out values. You can have good values or bad values. But if you think of it in the terms of those things as substantive, such as we're going to talk about, like honesty and thrift, and think of them as virtues, you can have an absence of a virtue, but there's no negative corollary to virtue. And we have actually recently rebranded, even on our website, that we fund character virtue development, with the emphasis, the pivotal word being virtue. So among the 19 specific character virtues that he left to us, certain ones are especially relevant both to the individual and to a nation. And these, as you might already suspect, do include honesty, but also generosity, gratitude, and reliability. But also just as critical are the values of entrepreneurship, diligence, and thrift. For Sir John, he felt that all of these virtues have a deeply spiritual essence. For example, in fact, I left this slide out. This was to follow the examples you had. So this is just to show you how the Bible, which Dad found is such a rich resource of wisdom, timeless wisdom, when he was probably 15, 16, or 17, living, albeit in the Bible Belt in Tennessee, his church asked him to be the superintendent of all the Sunday schools for kids and adults. So John my dad, if he took on something, he always took it on with full vigor. So I think it helped to actually cement much of the richness of God's Word. But if we just look at some of the examples in God's Word about truth and honesty, to testify to the truth, love rejoices with the truth by being the truth so that you have a sincere love for your brothers. A truthful witness gives honest testimony. Surely there could be no more valuable, timeless reference point for something as substantive as truth or honesty as a critical factor. So in each decade since 1960, and this is part of what I'd like to share with you by always going back and reflecting where we are now and where we might have been even only 50 years ago, I think there's abundant evidence of a steady rising number of embezzlement convictions and worker theft, certainly at least the theft of hard assets, but also additional evidence of the theft of company time. Of added poignancy, what insights might we be able to obtain in regard to the often quite bold attitudes of what might be called recidivist cheaters, who when questioned assert with conviction, "Of course I cheat. Everybody knows that the only goal in life is to get ahead, no matter what it takes." That's not an aberrational response. That is a relatively common response that you get even in interviewing kids who admit that they've been doing lots of plagiarism in high school. We could also learn from the tracking of data, for example, of reported thefts in schools, or more notably, the growing inability of youth in decade after decade to identify honesty as one of the most admired characteristics of their heroes. That might have been, certainly in earlier times, sports heroes or celebrities. Overall, the word honesty or even sportsmanship is largely not heard. Occasionally, it pops up if there's still a prize for someone in sports about sportsmanship, but the instinctive concept about being honest is just not part of what the culture even expects to hear or receive from others. So again, how would youth themselves, not now the father, but how would youth themselves respond to the question, why be honest? Lastly, when we pause to consider that youth spends, first, 3 to 4 more times captivated by the media versus hours in school. Second, 8 to 10 times more hours of immersion in media than time talking or eating with parents. And third, 40 times more immersion time with media messages than messages at church. Therefore, what I have perceived, because I don't generally watch a lot of situational comedies, but ones that have involved family or even schoolrooms, repeatedly more than any other factor, the youth are mocking their parents or mocking the teacher, therefore mocking authority, and therefore that's supposed to be what the high point of humor is. Let me show you this example from a year and a half ago in Atlanta newspapers. 178 teachers and principals in Atlanta public schools sought to artificially raise scores in high-stakes standard testing by, and I will explain in a moment when you see this woman's face, she was the superintendent of the schools at that time. Atlanta, 2 or 3 years before, had won, and therefore, as the superintendent, she featured the medal for the highest level of achievement of advanced achievement at a middle school. What they found, and it probably came out bits and drabs and then was all consolidated, is that it wasn't very efficient for teachers, knowing the weak students in school, in classroom, to go by and just put her finger on the correct answer. But just with thousands of students, that wasn't very efficient. So what they did is, after the period of all the testing was done and the answer sheets, is they went away for 2 or 3 weekends in a row and had erasure parties. They didn't erase it so that they suddenly had a 20% increase in student achievement scores. They made it like 88.3% increase. And at first it looked very good until the whole scandal broke out. I've often wondered if we were to do a research study with anonymity, I would bet that many of these teachers grew up in Atlanta and went to church and went to Sunday school. They grew up in a Christian culture, and yet something, through whatever process, it now seemed okay because we will get a bonus, et cetera, or recognition if we got higher scores, and therefore, let's have erasure parties. So then we move on to the theme about thrift, which is one that I think is also such a critical issue for our country. In the word thrift, which is a word that our grandparents, certainly our great-grandparents, strongly embraced, but a word that you almost never hear mentioned in the media, even when people are talking about too much government expenses and debt and that sort of thing, there's no positive parallel. So you can have either mental or verbal pictures, debt, debt, debt. There's no positive parallel to thrift. A lot of people, after things began to fall off and downward economic curve in 2008, began to save money or not have so much debt. But it was not out of the context socially and I would say even theologically in the 1920s. In the 1920s, Americans, however well off or not so well off, they saved 20% of every dollar that they earned in the 1920s. There were hundreds of thousands of thrift clubs. Even in rural communities, the farmers' wives, 8 or 10, would meet every other week and share ideas of how to have higher quality meals, clothes, or whatever they needed to share ideas about thrift. And many states had laws that you had to teach. They didn't even just say wisdom about money. They just said you're required at the junior in high school to teach about thrift. So I want to just now give a context because words do make a difference. In the 1200s, which is maybe the earliest that I could find about the word thrift, was from Old Norse, which means without thrift, no prosperity, no security, and no freedom. Then if we move up to the 1500s, the concept of thrift had changed into a somewhat larger specific concept of a habit of saving or economy. And therefore, we have a number of synonyms for thrift, including avoiding waste, prudence, care, and spending money. Here's an exercise that we today can approach but cannot complete. Specifically, when it comes to thrift in our 21st century American culture, at least one example gives us some insight for objective analysis. In 2007, there is the fact now from multiple sources that the personal savings rate of Americans in 2007, 1 year before things fell off the cliff, after everybody was saying the previous year, aren't we so smart, we figured out how to have permanent prosperity. The personal savings rate of Americans in 2007 was minus 3%. If I repeat, it was minus 3%. This is a perfect quantitative definition of an addiction to debt. Since we already addressed the question of why be honest, perhaps we can also explore more deeply two significant questions about thrift. Does thrift matter? And what is at stake if thrift is ignored? To start, as another aspect of my father's viewpoint, he saw that unless critical values that we already suggested of honesty, gratitude, diligence, and thrift are alive and vibrant in the heart of every youth, every person, every decision maker, then neither freedom nor its handmaiden free enterprise can survive. Dad clearly saw that these core fundamentals, irreducible features of character, are essential to citizenship in a free democratic republic. He also saw that only a citizenship that is emotionally jealous to preserve and enhance freedom can really appreciate the precious gift which we have received from the enormous sacrifices over dozens and hundreds of years of those who came before us. Thus, how can we not be overwhelmingly grateful, but are our hearts prepared? I mentioned earlier that I did a book, Thrift and Generosity. I hope that you're supposed to have here somewhere that you can get a free copy so you can pick it up afterwards. And the key premise of this is that thrift and generosity are not logically contradictory, but in fact have a lot more powerful synergy and effectiveness if they are clearly seen and acted upon together. This integration involves the concept of stewardship. At its essence, the heart of stewardship is both moral and spiritual. The all-encompassing worldview of stewardship is that, one, what we have, two, what we have earned, and even our own children do not belong to us. All of these and others are gifts from God for each one of us to nurture and to bring forth the fullest possible flowering of underlying potentialities. People talked that way in the 1800s in America. I'm not sure that I would be wise enough, and maybe one of you can reinforce I think America up until 1890 was an Old Testament Christian nation. If you look at many of the biblical references, even back to the founding fathers, they were very often founded in timeless wisdom, virtues, and spiritual realities out of the Old Testament. Of course, they believed in redemption and they believed in Jesus Christ, but they considered the entire Bible as relevant to how they lived and what was justice and everything else. So just as an overwhelming sense of gratitude is perhaps the most compelling motivator and guide to one's impulse to love others and for one to attempt to make a truly positive difference in life. Likewise, thrift is also one of the most elemental, powerful, and generative virtues. One can literally project the potential for success or the potential for failure for individuals, for families, and for communities and whole nations in regard to whether or not they are thrifty. The most important impact of thrift on the success or failure in a person's life or a life of a nation is that the question that thrift is not seen as a practical necessity, but as I was trying to capture back to the spirit of the 1920s and earlier in America, a passionate conviction about what it means to be a child of God, to be a Christian, and so on. Instead, thrift's most critical impact only exists, as I suggested, when there is a passionately held article of faith and conviction. If we first remember, and then if we relearn the lessons from Jesus' parable of the talents, we are all called as stewards to prosper what we have, not to bury it out of fear or laziness. This involves a stewardship and therefore also a passion for thrift that needs to be an instinctive expression of who and what we are. So let us consider other examples of thrift when looked at from one viewpoint or the other. With prudent responsibility, thrifty people understand that taking carefully considered risks are essential to progress, but they should approach the matter of risk not just with stewardship, but also with the enormous sense of empowerment when your instinctive feeling and living of thrift, or even more so when a nation honors thrift, that the effect is to promote both courage and resiliency no matter how hard the times are. Thus may no one in this generation or generations to come ever fail to stop and ask this unimpeachable question of prudence. Mr. Madoff, did you say that you can get me as an investor a 10% gain in assets per year and every year? Thousands invested. Just think of the psychology. If he'd said, I can get you 33% per year, somebody'd say, wait a minute. It sounded so plausible. Unless, which we will talk about later, is the critical matter not just of stewardship, but skeptical stewardship. I raised that question with Peter Loback and it led to a dialogue. He actually physically recoiled when I used the word skeptical, because the culture generally thinks that skeptical means doubt. But if you look at the Greek, skeptikos really means a constructive probing questioning to get to the essence of something. I think that our culture or educational system, if kids were taught not just to see the stewardship realms that we were talking about, but to be a deeply questioning skeptical, not to be negative, but a passion to say, if I looked at all the what-ifs that might be involved. And anybody who's ever studied anything about normal ebbs and flows of markets knows that you can't get 10%, even as modest as 10% per year. So this empowerment is best expressed, as I said, by the concept of skeptical stewardship. A skeptical steward would therefore never bury his talents in the ground. He would take these gifts and assets with care and imagination to first recognize every opportunity for prudent investments, but then, before making any decisions, to ask a series of what-if questions. I could imagine in an educational system that also not only allowed the questions like why, that by the time kids were sophomores and juniors, they could actually have built into their mind of curiosity, if nothing else, that when they address something they haven't heard before, to instinctively say, what if? To take imagination and turn it around even 180 degrees and just try to analyze it, even if you're not yet a great statistician or anything else, just logically to reanalyze something from the perspective of what if. So not the least, one critical what if question is, does the common sense that my grandmother kept preaching in regard to some enticing proposition tell me that even in 10%, this is too good to be true? Having tested the waters of prudence and common sense, which are so vital to stewardship, then one may much more confidently proceed as a proactive investor in quality. Finally, and perhaps of most critical importance, thrifty people do not expect to get something for nothing. I remember, so if you've had a bad day, I suggest you get cassettes, because you can still get them, of great old-time radio shows of Bob Hope and Jack Benny and so on. So in the period after World War II, and I've heard it, and I think I know where I can find it, Hope at the end, like 47, 46, 47, would say, let's remember about CARE. CARE stands, the E part stands for Europe, which were kids and others who were starving in the aftermath of World War II. Can't we think of giving a little bit more here? In one end of the program, he says, may we all as Americans be so grateful to the citizens of the state of New York that this week they voted down state-sponsored gambling by 68%. America is grateful. Today, we have at least 40 of the 50 states that push the lotteries. And we don't have the time to explore it. In the question of what is justice, because many people see justice in actually very narrow terms, they often don't even say, as Christians, what are the suffering, persecuted Christians around the world if we're going to ask questions of justice? But let's come back to our home country. Of the quintiles of earnings, what quintile of earning do you think probably put 50% of the money every week into lotteries? It's the lowest quintile. And it's not perfect science, but if you just look at where the money's invested simply by zip codes, you get a pretty good handle on it. So let me just continue to pursue a little bit more. Benjamin Franklin, who adopted Philadelphia, he was born in Boston. He had a strong reformed Christian Presbyterian background. A lot of wonderful stories about him. But Benjamin Franklin abhorred debt. Of all his various maxims, although he, if you get some of the summary of his various quotations that are sort of condensed out of Poor Richard's Almanac, there's a lot of things that are of deep things that people should be deeply concerned about. So let me just raise a question. If you go back and read the various things that he was talking about, which is not just debt, but all the other issues he raised, he did not see human nature through rose-colored glasses. He saw people, and indeed many of the people in his time and culture, saw people in reality just for what they were. So if he saw in that time where people were a lot more poor, where life was a little bit more fragile and so on, he would say we should all avoid debt. He would himself, even at a time where there was an earlier concept of self-government, think what you do when you run into debt. You give to another power over your liberty. So how much of our not so far away in terms of accountability have we given our liberty to countries we are deeply in debt to, like China, the Middle East? By 2014, this is now data from 2 years ago, the projection was the U.S. annual foreign and domestic interest on debt will equal the entire U.S. military budget. So what would a nation want to consider as to whether they would continue to propagate debt? Presently, the Fed has created a system of something like $80 billion a month that they are effectively, so if you want a company to invest in, it's the Gutenberg Printing Company. They're not printing Bibles, but they are printing something else of paper. And they can't get even most Americans or even the Chinese to buy this new debt released every month. So who buys it? The federal government. So if you want to understand in that larger sense what Ponzi schemes are, eventually it all comes collapsing as a house of cards. So let me just move on to one other aspect. In terms of thrift versus debt, that America, in many, many trillions of debt, I think that it's quite clear that this debt is being intentionally stoked at the highest level. Faster and faster, if you just look at the data, not just of how the rising of debt is, but the part above it, which is the increased interest, a percentage of interest that we owe each year. I won't go into the various concepts of how fragile that is when if there's some tiny element in which the U.S. by for 1 month says Is it okay if we pay only 99% of our interest this month? The whole stack of cards will come unraveled. It's called a debt crisis. I'm not an expert economically, but I don't think you have to be much more than a common sense person to understand when a nation at the most fundamental root has lost any concept of thrift. So might we in a certain sense consider that what has happened to us or we have allowed to happen is a matter for national shame, and that somehow we can't just keep saying, well, what can I do? Instead, I think most people have sort of assumed, well, somebody in Washington or some new very smart person who's coming into as a new secretary of this and that will take care of it. Thomas Jefferson, whom I mentioned before, always railed against high levels of national debt. He warned that the most powerful and highly destructive agencies in the future would be government institutions. Today, Jefferson has been proven to be totally accurate in his predictions. Across the country, as we've been suggesting, there are hundreds and hundreds of examples of profligacy ranging from county commissions to school boards to state governments, and again, especially at the federal level. Especially, or sadly, the vital lessons of history and human civilizations from Rome right up to our own civilization are meaningless if they are not intentionally and proactively taught in terms of examples of what to avoid and therefore to pursue the opposite. Therefore, might we say that so each person or a nation avoids deeply harmful or potentially even fatal mistakes, we need to become experts in the history of human experience that reveals to us an immutable law of life, that whole nations rise and fall depending upon whether or not they are thrifty. Therefore, perhaps an appropriate alternate title for our message today is The Character of Thrift, Without Which No Democracy. Dad told me years ago that in the small county seat, which I suggested to you earlier, where he grew up in Tennessee in the 1920s, it didn't matter how wealthy you were or what your social status was. What people most admired and proactively spoke about approvingly were simple things such as whether your word is your bond. Where in America's national executive today is there any concept that one's word is one's bond? These diagrams that Pina helped put together, if a picture, sometimes are better than words. If we have a culture that prizes this and this, it certainly adds to a larger sense of trust in a family, in a community, even in a national government. But if one gets to a situation that so characterizes where we are today, that when freedom begins to die, there is, combined with that, little left by way of trust, and therefore no freedom, and especially as a result, you can't sustain any kind of concept of self-government. If the keeping of one's word is then perhaps one of the most critical components for trust, and if trust is also critical to thrift, what can we see as parents, employees, fellow workers, and citizens? Perhaps we might awaken out of our torpor if we were to think of ourselves as proactive character doctors. Thus, we are indeed caring citizens. Then who is our patient? Our patient is our own country. Might our instinctive common sense spring to life when we assertively explore the essential interrelationships, one, of thrift, two, of trust, and three, the keeping of one's word? Finally, if such character virtues are like the blood that keeps the nation's actual body alive and healthy, does the vast collapse of the rejection and abnegation of thrift require a sense of national urgency that one associates with an intensive care unit? America needs voices that come from all of us at the grassroots level, not somebody else surely is smarter than I, they know economics better, surely he or she will take care of it. That's not what America is based on. Just to give you a little kind of exchange, you don't have to answer in the shortness of time. What is the basis of the sovereignty of the United Kingdom, or of Holland, or of Sweden? It is the crown. What is the basis of America's sovereignty, about which many, but especially Thomas Jefferson said, is the totally exclusive basis of sovereignty in America? Anyone have a word? Popular sovereignty. It is the will of the people. in this very city when they finally completed, after lots of pulling and stresses and uncertainty, and came up with a constitution. In human nature, since everybody knew that these were the exemplars from Virginia, Jefferson wasn't there, but of Madison and other people like that, they could have conceivably rolled out with a wonderful scroll in front of what we now call Independence Hall and said, America, this is your constitution. Actually, on the day that people knew in the town that it was all wrapped up, Franklin walked out a couple of hundred yards in front, and a lady came up and said, Dr. Franklin, what kind of government have you given us? He said, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. The wisdom of what they understood, that they didn't come there to be the potentates. They said, whatever we can do with God's judgment and guidance, it goes back to the people. And then the people finally had to decide. And yet how practical they were, because at the end of the agreement, they said, 9 states must approve this to make it the law of the land. Because they knew that if they made it 13 states, they might be some aboriginal state who just kept, you know, not stepping forward and agreeing. Of course, once they got 9 states, it became the law of the land, and the others then joined. But I think it's so important to understand these things, which are part of the character of the people at the time. So let me just move them beyond the concept of national sovereignty. My father, in 2005, predicted in a memo that he entitled Financial Chaos, the chaos which he saw would soon burst upon us. He saw with crystal clear accuracy how that pathology would unfold. And among the handouts I have provided is a copy of that memo. By early 2009, of course, we could more clearly understand the etiology of that pathology. Dad himself did not know how pervasive what was contributing to so much of the national debt and excessive expenditures. It was a pathological assault of thrift through some 15 pieces of legislation, mostly at the federal government, with the unstated assertion that every American has an unalienable right to a private house, even if they do not have $1 of collateral. In conclusion, I would like to close with the reflection that thrift cannot be an isolated virtue. It is a virtue that can only prosper and thrive if it is coupled with other virtues, such as ones we discussed earlier, honesty, ethics, gratitude, reliability, diligence, and beneficial purpose. America's founding fathers and later wise and discerning leaders clearly understood that unless virtue pervades our culture from every hearth to every industry to every hall of government, and in fact are intentionally shaped and guided by our leaders, then no experiment in liberty and self-government can survive. I hope that very much that as you return to your homes, and also as you reflect on what your schools and your communities stand for, that you will first ponder and then share just a few of the voices from our heritage who loved liberty so much that they stood ready to sacrifice anything and everything for it. As we share together just a few voices from America's heritage, may we be able to also hear a consistent sub-theme in what they said. That sub-theme is, do not ever take anything for granted. So, we mentioned earlier Benjamin Franklin. We might hear his voice, and if you can read the quotation, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become more corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. John Adams said this, or the equivalent to this, just a week before the Declaration of Independence was signed. He said, public virtue cannot exist in a nation without private virtue. And of public virtue, that can be the only basis for a survivable republican form of government. Later, as America struggled painfully to be truly much more of the land of justice that so evoked in Lincoln what he thought was the most unsurpassable document of all of American history, namely the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, Frederick Douglass, even in his later times, said, the life of a nation is secure only while the nation is honest, truthful, and virtuous. And finally, jumping backwards in time, among so many other voices of discerning wisdom, we have the voice of courage and certitude from William Penn, who most of you know had the vision and then the reality of creating our Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He said, right is right, even if everyone is against it. Wrong is wrong, even if everyone is for it. So from my father's perspective, America's youth clearly hunger not for easy promises of hope, but the kind of substance, the kind of resiliency that develops when they awaken with your loving guidance to exactly what William Penn meant when he made the distinction clearly between right is right and wrong is wrong. With these words, we all try to find in small ways to be a part of what we hope will be a growing number of voices of conviction at the grassroots level. I want to share again my father's deepest respect and admiration for what all of you do from perhaps 50 different walks of life as you labor in your separate vineyards. If he could be with us, he would want to share with you this passage from Matthew chapter 6, which deeply motivated and animated him. And you know it very well. It says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, but where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." So in closing, just a few reflections of what Dad, who many people thought of as just an ebullient optimist, but who deeply inside himself was truly a skeptical steward because he never stopped asking individual questions. And so if he were to provide any added advice, he would urge us, as we look for a more vibrant, resilient life and rejoices in God's love, yet not to worry, for which there are clear passages in Scripture, if your mind is where it is in terms of where God is, but on faithfully answering the call, in the case of what we've been talking about, to honesty and thrift. And so, back to my grandsons. "Okay, Dad, I will be honest. Me too." And the little one way over here says, "Well, I'm little. I haven't decided yet." So in conclusion, thank you all very much.
Thank you, Dr. Templeton. We have some time for questions.
I'll let you know. Can you speak so they can hear in the back? Yes, thank you. And if you look at some of the things my father wrote and even some things we have on the website, or especially if you look at what one funds, you know, there's a lot of wisdom that I appreciate if you ever listen to Dennis Prager, who I think is one of the wisest persons in terms of culture in a spiritual context. I mean, it's painful to hear him say, because he still lives that pain of going through yeshivas all the way through senior year and then going to Columbia. He could not believe the vast cruelty and viciousness of the hyper-secularity that he saw there. It stunned him, and he then went to graduate school. I heard him today on the radio said, they taught so much vile trash as what was supposed to be evidence and truth, even in graduate schools. It took me years to sort that out. Anyway, Dennis Prager, who has a lot of Christians, and by the way, he has a new movie that you might want to get. It's called Baseball Prager. Anyway, if you look up on his site, Baseball, Prager, and so-and-so, it's a dialogue and simplicity that he had because people call up and they talk about things. One of the things he tries to say, and I think it has a particular Jewish perspective, because Christians will say, "Yes, but what do you believe?" Now, that's a little bit of a danger to say this in this church, but what do you believe? He says, "In the end, I pay attention to what a person does," which is so much a reflection of where their real beliefs are. And that's what we've lost in this culture, is accountability. There are no persons in the media, for the most part, that call some of the profligates, the biggest profligates in our country, to accountability. So it's not that the John Templeton Foundation is a judgment foundation, but it is very much centered, not just that we deal and fund things in terms of some of the rarest aspects of what might be a breakthrough in things that I can't read even more than the first sentence, on the highest mathematical level of infinity, or various aspects of cosmology and so on. But a lot of what we do deal with, including the virtues, are about people. And I've been reaching to try and understand the essence of my father's perspective on those parts of things that we fund, including individual freedom, free enterprise, and I will pick that one of them is voluntary family planning. If you acculture yourself to look at a sentence or a title, sometimes a whole paragraph, most of the time, you can find one pivotal word or concept. So remember now, Dad wrote those words into the charter. When I use those three words, voluntary family planning, what do you think is the most pivotal word? Voluntary. He already knew by that time what China had been doing. I mean, I think it still remains to be sorted out in the incredible, not intended, it's like unintended consequences. I think today of men who are 20 to maybe 28 years of age, they represent a 20% higher percentage of gender of male in that age group than female. With no females and just understanding, as Dennis Prager says all the time, please don't try to make females into males or males into female. Respect them as they are. There's so much wisdom that he's trying to break through the stupid morass of people sort of saying everybody must sort of be the same sort of thing. So if males have an inclination to be more aggressive and more assertive, and indeed the wisdom of the ages is that magic of domesticity when two people find each other and they're in love and they have a greater sense that my identity now is not just me, but my family, my wife, my children. What does it mean for a powerful nation, rising powerful nation, who in 3 years will have a massively more powerful blue water navy than the United States? What does it mean when 20% of the males of the young, vigorous types have no one that they could have as a family and so on? And, of course, you know from simple technology how they were able to have so many more males. Even in the primitive years of ultrasound, they could scan. It wasn't perfect, but if they saw that it did not look like a penis, then they did higher levels of selective gender abortion. And indeed, you hear smatterings of story where sometimes, for money or otherwise, they've been trying to go to countries like Vietnam and sort of almost buy a woman to be their wife. So let me come back again to the voluntary part. If the 19 virtues are so central, and it is about for a person and then expanded to a family and to a whole society, how could you ever look at an issue of responsible family planning if it wasn't voluntary? So I'm just trying to say, in the end, I think Dad's vision of what he funded, and we later found things in his writings, essays, and so on. And now let me ask you, what do you think is the essence of every single human being, past, present, and future? It's in Scripture. I mean, you know, people say you can find anything you want in Scripture. So, and it's also like, what's in my mind? Why don't you know what's in my mind? So I knew what I was looking for. It's in the first chapter of Genesis, and it is that man is made in the image of God, imago Dei. That is so profound, and if that is part of your conviction of the people aspect of reality and life, how could you ever think that you would try and help family planning unless it was voluntary, where they understood and voluntarily did something, or if you were not using the virtues that we were talking about? So if I answer at that long-winded way about the foundation, it is what we clearly understand from our charter, what are our core seven funding purposes or categories. And I don't have time to go in the big one, but it's 60% or more must be funding in humility and theology. So of those three words, what would you think is the pivotal word in that title? It's humility. And it's part of his perspective, and you can have various viewpoints on it, that God just didn't give us a spirit, a tie to the Holy Spirit, but he gave us the minds, just like the treasures that we were called upon in the parable of the talents to optimize. He loved to have little simple paradigms, quantitative, that what would it mean if you were 30 years of age, and partly from the spirit and partly from the mind, it could be said you knew 6% of the totality of God. And because your mind was also leading through questions, curiosity, testing, comparison, and so on, that you died at 65 years of age knowing 7% of the totality of God. How could you not have a life of joy that you would have come that closer to the sense of understanding God? If I then bring a little bit back more in the human sense, his understanding of human nature was that it's not intrinsically good. So now help me with a thought experiment. If we enlist 10 of you, and you can do little recording machines as we have now, and you started at Broad Street, and there are 10 streets all the way over to the Delaware, and every person you met, you have two or three questions that make them feel you're not a axe murderer. And then you say, well, tell me, do you think human nature is basically good? And then all 10 people get to the Delaware River and they add up their results. What percent would say, well, yes, human nature is basically good? I'm asking you by intuitive empathy of effectively your own culture, Philadelphia. What percent would say, yes, human nature is basically good? 90, okay. Any other numbers? I don't have numbers. You can make a lot of learning, self-learning things by doing thought experiments even when you don't have the hard data. I sometimes say 70 or 80%. Now let's take a trip. Same city, same Broad Street, same river, 100 years ago. You can't do it as a recording. You'd have a little notepad. It takes a little bit longer, but you, in effect, covers 500 people just as you might in the earlier paradigm. When you get to the Delaware River and now have notes to compare on 500 people 100 years ago, what percent would have said that human nature is basically good? I think that's not bad. I mean, just in reality, there was a higher dimensionality of the world's immigration who came to ports like Philadelphia and New York out of shtetls, out of trying to escape being in the Kaiser's army and one thing or another. They knew a lot about what life was really like. Also, Christians and Jews really knew Proverbs and many other things as well. So there were lots of dimensions in which I think, for the most part, they saw life for what it was. This is not entering into the question, because I'm not sure that Dad would consider productive to say, oh, humans are intrinsically bad. But if you have a society at 90% or 70% that says human nature is basically good, it creates one trap mental paradigm, which I call wishful thinking. If you think they're basically good and there's this problem or that, well, because it's all good, somehow it's going to all work out. Or somebody's smart enough to figure out the issue. You can't survive as a free society based upon wishful thinking. What caught my attention as a result of the election in 2008 are the people who were then being appointed as secretary of this and secretary of that in the first administration. The New York Times, they kind of had an obvious sense of who was probably going to be appointed, so they were ready the moment the day before they announced so-and-so for secretary of treasury and so on. Every one of those articles trying to tell about background said on an average 5 times in every article, X, he or she is so smart. So now let's take another thought experiment. Harvard University, it's kind of a good time of the semester. There are not exams right now. It's a Friday evening and you have 50 people who are full professors or associate professors. It's pretty secure, job security and everything else. And it's just a relaxed cocktail party. And someone during that cocktail party wants to say something really nice about somebody who's not there. What would they almost uniformly say? X is so smart. They would never say X is so wise, has had adversity, had problems, learned how to adjust, and to therefore somehow come out with more resilience and more wisdom. The word wise is so much as one grant we got, and I'll have to condense it, was a model that they had of, because they knew we were funding research on wisdom. And part of the part that they even did a pilot on, so it's nice, that helps us to get a sense of whether their paradigm would work. He says, well, we're going to interview people on the street, and we're going to ask them, who do you think is the most wise person, either living or dead? And then they showed us the results from the pilot, which was 100 people, but they then wanted to do 1,000. 70% said the wisest person who's ever lived was Bill Clinton. When wisdom, just think of what William Penn was trying to say. When wisdom is a popularity contest, and then it's a measure of the culture and so on. This is why I think that our culture is in such stress, because we're not backing off and sort of challenging things that people say when they're preposterous. So I'm sorry that's a long-winded answer. I hope I framed it in the sense that Dad really did see many of the things, not when you're studying cosmology or things of the essence of even creation, long before humans ever existed or even life on Earth existed, which is part of what we do, but those things that are of the human aspect, what is, and I sort of have, I think, enough evidence to verify this, even to my own staff, of Sir John knowing that humans were not intrinsically good, what he really saw in his quiet, because he was not an emotive sort of person, pained him, is that he saw that probably the most characteristic feature of human nature is passivity of thought, and where either because the why question you used to ask at 5 years of age had then been thoroughly extinguished, or somehow the culture doesn't foster why or other kinds of proliferative kind of questions, it also makes you pretty likely to be a fatalistic person. If you're of a mass of people passive and also fatalistic, that's pretty hard to sustain a free society as well. So he had, as he liked to think of as sort of images, if you can do something that might be in science or what people call science, also the better thing is to remember the root of words. What is the root of the word science?
Scientia.
Scientia, which is a Latin word. So now, what is the motto of the University of Chicago? Before you answer, I will have to tell you that my Latin teacher, being a wise country guy from Georgia and loved Latin and had gone to the University of Chicago, said, now you're not going to remember declensions and conjugations, but you must have timeless things to have in your mind that you never forget, things that I call cocktail ammunition or social ammunition that you can bring up when discussions are dull. Now that, I won't be able to sing it well, but I will sing a few bars of Mica, Mica, Parwa, Stella, Mirwar, Quinam, Sis, Tumbella. What is that? Mica? Twinkle, twinkle, little star. That's what I got out of my high school education. But that's cocktail. Anyway, the better one was the motto of the University of Chicago, which is Crescat Scientia, Vita Excelatur. As I was thinking about that last week, one of the mysteries to me, even in high school, and I would say I never really understood the English language in its essence until I had even just 2 years of Latin. It always a mystery to me that with so few letters in Latin, it always seemed to add up to twice as many words or letters in English to explain it. So I'm going to now tell you what the translation is. It means let knowledge, that's what science is. That's scientia just means knowledge. Let knowledge grow from more to more, and so be human life enriched. Only at the University of Chicago, it's just four words. Now you can help me and come back via email for a cultural excursion. If that Latin stuff sort of began somewhere on some place they call Italy, why is it today that when Italians want to describe something, it takes twice as many Italian words to do it that you can do in English? Somehow, when those barbarians, I blame it on the barbarians brought in verbosity or something. Anyway, that's such a great wise thing as Prescott Scantia Vita Excalatur. That means everything that you teach or learn when you read a newspaper, you are part, if your mind is so attuned, to a science search. So many people are imprisoned, oh, science, test tubes, I just don't like that sort of stuff. So then they trap their own minds. So again, if I come back to Dad's concept, if you were to do things that for those who are science interested, maybe new concepts that maybe there's even something smaller than a quark, or something that would be of a social science part, or something in philosophy and so on, whatever you were doing, if you can package it, not just to get a decent result, something that would be respectable in high-quality journals, but also have a relevance to what we are now trying to say more and more. It's not just the primary audience. So many of these things would therefore be in a physics journal. We must, even as we ask of applicants, tell us a critical secondary audience. So it could be at least kids smart enough at the Bronx High School of Science. They're not yet creating great inventions. And yet, on many of these things, they should be relevant, particularly perhaps in the social sciences, and even at somewhat lower levels in terms of age and wisdom and so on. So that's what we're trying to get across. If you can capture somebody who said, gee, I never thought of that before, you've captured now a slight opening of a mental door that they might begin to ask some questions. They might go on the marvel of modern history, which is Wikipedia, whatever. They might begin to become proactive and not a passive thinker. And then, of course, in a larger sense, if you have the support, not just from one foundation, but more largely, a system that prompts people to be proactive, that's part of what my father felt would be the blessing of empowering people to be their own discovery agents. So I'm very long-winded when you were asking, what's the foundation do? Any other? Yes?
Can you quote it, social justice or the attainment of particular good. So access to housing or access to some other kind of good. What I find intriguing about your foundation is its work is more about an internal kind of self and character or virtue development. Do you find that you have peers in philanthropy who are also interested in that kind of personal growth investment, or are you increasingly that you're standing alone?
So even the foundations who do things like soup kitchens, you know, a measurable result, because my father really felt that this is an investment. This is not a charity when you're involved from his mind. So accountability, and if you're doing with feeding the hungry, you might increase next by 1 year 30%. Most of that is unidirectional. So one of our core categories is individual freedom, with the emphasis, in this case, the pivotal word is individual, and also free enterprise with different components like entrepreneurship. So might some of you be old enough to say, when you needed to earn extra money, so some of you might have been a kid in the 1950s or the 1960s, what would you do to earn some extra money? Yeah. Or would you have had a lemonade stand? You hear them, I don't know if CNN covers it, but if you listen to Fox News, they love to hype these sort of things. It says, not all the time, because policemen actually are pretty decent people. They hate some of the laws they're asked to enforce. But they'll come up to a kid who's had a lemonade stand and they've made $10 a day for 2 days. And he says, I'm sorry, young lady, could you show me your $300 business license? Literally, it's in the laws. If you look at an analysis, I think it's called the Institute of Justice, which big city in America is the most anti-free enterprise, anti-entrepreneurship for the poor to be able to make a little bit of a stature to build up something of independence? It's Philadelphia. The laws and the restrictions on people, it's a little bit, I can understand somewhat about street vendors and so on, but across the board, it's suppressive of people just being innovative. So I don't know what, I mean, I'm for more because we have a culture of a lot of predators and so on out there, and I have, at least I raised, Pina and I raised daughters. But when it wasn't the winter season, when I asked Dad when I was 10 that my main Christmas present was a really good, strong, and user-friendly shovel, snow shovel. And they had great snows in those days in the closed school, and I'd go easily in a morning, I could cover 8 homes, driveways, and sidewalks. And of course, they looked at this freezing little skinny 10-year-old kid, and they kept doubling the price they wanted to pay and then pay off in chocolate as well. So you can make a lot of money in one day. It was a little harder in the summer, but someone had said, look, you need to do a lot of things like shine your own shoes. So I had as another present one of those great old-fashioned shoe boxes. I would go from door to door and say, would you like me to shine some shoes? And I'd say, they're $2 a pair or 3 pairs for $5. It's primitive, but it's an element of entrepreneurship. That spontaneity is crushed in our society. So if I were to come back to your viewpoint, the kind of people that we support, I'm on the free enterprise theme, is directed to poor kids, usually ethnic minorities in New York City. It's called NIFTY, the National Foundation for the Teaching of Entrepreneurship. They are a newer but very effective, because they have something of a bigger city orientation from, I'm forgetting the name of the other group that's been doing it for 100 years, but basically going to high schools, helping kids to think of an idea, helping them to write little business plans. And in both settings, one 100 years, if I remember the name, I'll say it, and the other one, they actually encourage to start a business, and if it has shows some vitality, and now they're going to go to college perhaps, they might sell it for $150 or sometimes $500. So then they understand they can come through their imagination, not to be limited, understand basic concepts, and become at least knowing what an entrepreneurship is. Can you tell me of the entire persons in the U.S. federal administration, including 32 czars? Do you know what, can you tell me what one czar is doing? Can you tell me what their federal tax burden budget is on an average per czar? A transparent government? I don't think that one single one of them could understand what a simple entrepreneurial opportunity is. Now, some business people, so-called conservatives, say, well, they don't know what a bottom line is. But the bottom lines count even in your early aspects of getting a job. I hope I haven't tried to not answer your question, but I do want to say, if the issue is social justice, what about justice? And what about a sense of perspective? And this is, I assume, basically a Christian community. Have you ever imagined, maybe some of you know, and maybe it depends on, maybe the church has a ministry such as the Voice of the Persecuted and so on, how hard it is to be a Christian in Pakistan? 2 years ago, they had a Christian, and he wasn't, you know, out trying to push his Christianity on people, but people knew he was a Christian. He was a minister in the government. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was tourism. Maybe it was highways or something. It wasn't as if he was at the top. And I even forgot the city, but it would be a place like Islamabad. He had his car, and he's had his two bodyguards, and they were going through the main center square, and a guy came up with multiple bullets and shot all the guards and this minister to death. What do you think happened next? 5,000 people in the square saw, they knew who it was, they saw exactly what happened, they knew who he killed, they put him on their shoulders and paraded around the square as a great hero of the people. What is it like to be a Christian in Pakistan? If you look at Bethlehem today, let's go back 80 years ago, or it could have been longer. Let's go 80 years ago. What percent of people whose home was Bethlehem do you think were Christian 80 years ago? Give me a number. I mean, that's thought experiments. Thought experiments are supposed to make you make a declaration. No, it was 85. First, that's where the pilgrims came, and you go to these shops and they have cedar wood, like old times crosses and precious and one thing or another. They did an okay business, particularly with Easter and whatnot. How many Christians do you think live in Bethlehem today? Less than 5%. How many, if you think of the Chaldean Christians, you ever heard of them? What faith tradition in the Christian sense are they tied to for 2,000 years? It's the Catholic Church. Probably they were variants because the Catholic Church makes a lot of accommodations for culture and so on. They've been there for 2,000 years. 10 years ago, from today backwards, there were 2.5 million Chaldean Christians who had their businesses and they had their place. Even in the Saddam Hussein's government, that killer, that dictator, his foreign minister was a Christian. Today, out of 2.5 million Chaldean Christians, how many by percentage are left in Iraq? 5%. You know, it's amazing to me that Christians in some places are protected in a certain sense, so long as they're not trying to overthrow the government or things like that, under a tyrant. So let me ask you another question. I hope we're not going too far afield. In January 2011, first beginning in Tunisia and then really exploding, at least in terms of what we pay attention to because it's such a big player, in Egypt. And by middle January, they called it the Arab Spring. Can somebody just say, what did that make you think in January 2011? Arab Spring. What did that make you think? Well, let's put it simple. Does that make you think positive or negative? Raise your hand if you thought that sounded positive. Anybody who thought it sounded negative? Well, that's interesting. Maybe at coffee you can tell me why you thought of it as negative. But let me just say, I think in the vague sense, especially Americans, they said, this is great. Thomas Jefferson now has a flat in Cairo. And they're going to come talk to him, and they're all going to be Jeffersonian Democrats. Can you tell me through Egypt, and then you can go to virtually all the Middle East, whenever there was any cultural root of a sense of grassroots democracy, the adjustments that we sometimes call compromise in one thing or another, but also a larger sense of equality under the law. And then imagine yourself, at least since the year 800, to be a Coptic Christian in Egypt. I mean, even before that time, they took 5 years to be allowed to repair the holes in their roof, much less build a church and that sort of thing. But it was sold by people who know that people don't ask questions. Arab Spring, that sounds great. You know, it's going to be fresh, new life, and it'll be all turned around. Someone who is a leading international free enterprise person sent us, wanted money from us to do a movie, because the first incident actually was a small businessman, sort of a street merchant in, I forget the city, well, Tunisia anyway. And the police were hounding him so much, even finally stealing his stuff. And he would appeal to the government and they wouldn't listen. He immolated himself. And that was so emotionally powerful, because that's not so much, maybe they do that in some sense in Asia, but that was so striking. That sort of galvanized lots of people. So we were sent, send us money to do a movie to prove that the Arab Spring now will cause a bursting forth of free enterprise, rule under the law, everybody treated equally, and so on. If one doesn't have at least an instinct for a moment to have skeptical stewardship and just say, wait a minute, there has never been any of the things. So I'm probably talking too much, but let me just ask you, how many of you feel, can tell me between one of the two, which came first, freedom or culture? All right. All the hands who said freedom came first, raise your hand. Okay? All who said culture came first, raise your hand. So a guy named Hugh Hewitt has a great radio show, and a lot of these guys, I guess they earn extra money, they take cruises, and my wife bore the burden of traveling with me, because that year, which was 3 years ago, you started in southern England, and you went to kind of port all the way up over the top and all the way back to the south. Pina sort of wanted to see lots of things, but I said, no, I'm going to find in one of these ports where it was in the year 1602 that freedom leaped out of the ground fully formed. I mean, the Magna Carta was important. It was so narrow, which was simply about part of nevertheless an elemental genius of true freedom, which was there should be freedom best measured at the local level. The British tradition is that for most things, as opposed to France and that sort of thing, you don't adjudicate things mainly at the central government. You do them where people know the person or they know the circumstances, and trial by jury. You don't have trial by jury in most of Europe. It's Napoleon. It's all from the top down. So it was years of culture of rising and falling. Even the nobles that thought they had beaten and whipped or intimidated King John, most of them got marginalized after about 50 years. So that was a huge amount of slow acculturation over hundreds of years until finally you got people like Edmund Burke and others who actually, I mean, he was pretty public, so you have to give Britain credit. The Whigs in England said the Parliament that was controlled by the King and the Parliament were abusing Americans. So I'll leave you with just one other aspect about some of the things we suggested earlier. We know about the Stamp Act, we know about the Boston Tea Party and various things that the British government was doing because they felt, well, we have to get more revenue and whatnot. Of all the petitions that the colonists sent back to Parliament, up until something like, well, so they declared Declaration of Independence in 1776, up until at least 1773, all of the petitions began in essence, this thing, well, I'm forgetting the dates, but could it be Stamp Act? You were violating our rights as British subjects. They had acquired over 100 years a concept that there was more of a sense that you can, as they ended up saying, no taxation without representation, but they were really trying to say, we know the situation here. We should have the right to be able to make, as a variety of counties back in the home country have, the freedom to make vital decisions on their own behalf. And eventually they gave up with the petitions, and of course we had the Declaration of Independence. So my question that you might, after you've thought about it, is once we won the revolution, which is so improbable, and then it was floundering around with the Confederation, even though they called it the United States, and those incredibly wise people knowing philosophy and history, economics over sometimes 2,000 years, came to Philadelphia to try and put something together that works. I think the genius of British culture, and therefore American culture, is that they have a passion still for the science of what works, not from some mass theory that you then try to shove down people's throats. So my question that you can share with me, what were all those people who came to Philadelphia in 1787 most afraid of? I think maybe we should have tea, coffee, or Jell-O. I hope I'm not cutting it off. It's gotten late, I'm afraid. Thank you all very much.